this is The Takeaway for Monday, January 29th, 2018. And hey, if you like this podcast, head to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. Thanks.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. And we start in Afghanistan, where hundreds of civilians were caught in a deadly terror attack over the weekend. On Saturday, Taliban suicide bombers drove an ambulance past a security checkpoint in Kabul and then detonated their explosives. Afghan officials say at least 103 people died in that attack and roughly 235 more were wounded. Then earlier today, a group of Islamic State militants killed 11 Afghan soldiers and injured 16 in an attack outside of a military academy, Kabul. These attacks are just the latest in a string of violent bombings carried out over the past year in Afghanistan. Joining me now is Barnett Rubin, director of the Afghanistan-Pakistan Regional Program at NYU Center on International Cooperation. He's also a former advisor to both the U.S. State Department and the United Nations. Barnett, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
What do these latest bombings say about the state of Afghanistan now?
I think they say that the Taliban and their sponsors in Pakistan have found a way to reply very forcefully to the new U.S. strategy. In particular, a Taliban spokesman has told a journalist that because of the increased use of air power, they're unable to move around as much in the countryside and may be losing control of territory. But rather than accepting that they're being defeated, of course, they have responded by increasing very spectacular acts of terror in the urban areas, and particularly in the heart of Kabul, the capital, which undermines people's confidence in the government, whatever there was left of it. And that's a government that is going through a very severe political crisis right now in any case.
Now, you're drawing a direct line, Barnett, from U.S. policies in Pakistan and Afghanistan under the Trump administration to this new violence. What is the U.S. doing differently? Refresh us, please.
The U.S. is in the process of sending about 1,000 more troops to Afghanistan and has said that there's no timeline for withdrawing them, and has also greatly relaxed the rules on the use of air power. This is what the Taliban spokesman mentioned, so that the U.S. is now using a lot more bombing raids in support of military operations on the ground. It's acting even independently of the Afghan forces, which is limiting the Taliban's operations in the countryside. The U.S. claims that this will eventually gain control of more territory and population and force the Taliban to negotiate. I think these series of bombings say that we have ways of responding that actually may be even more threatening to you and the Afghan government than taking territory in remote areas of the country. We can hit you right at the center and undermine people's confidence in the government and its unity.
Now, that's in Afghanistan, Barnett Rubin. What about in Pakistan? President Trump has decided to pull back on aid to Pakistan. Is there a connection between that decision and what might be going on across the border?
I don't know for certain. The Afghan authorities have indicated that, as usual, they have evidence tying these attackers to people in Pakistan, that is to say, not necessarily people in the Pakistan government, but Afghan Taliban who are in safe havens in Pakistan. And everyone in Afghanistan, at least, certainly everyone in Kabul, believes firmly that these attacks are masterminded by Pakistan. So it could be. I'm not saying it's true because I don't have the evidence yet. But it is certainly widely believed in Afghanistan that this is an attempt by the very secretive part of the Pakistan intelligence agency that supports the Afghan Taliban to show the Americans that their attempt to put pressure on Pakistan will fail and that they have to come to the table on Pakistan's terms and accept something that thus far the U.S. hasn't been willing to accept.
At the same time, there's a power struggle between the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, and a provincial leader in that country. How is that contributing?
That is more than just a struggle between two individuals. It actually is a struggle over two very important political forces in the country over how the state is to be structured. Should it be controlled by the center, or should provinces and localities and ethnic groups in the regions have more autonomous power? Because this governor claims that he has a mandate from his own people, even though constitutionally he is merely appointed by the president, who is trying to remove him. That has already created some tensions within the security forces, to the point that the president had to publicly warn the security forces not to be involved in politics. And Vice President Pence also called up to tell them to resolve this peacefully. And each side will use this as leverage against the other. So it's a very dangerous situation. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal this morning, people in Kabul, even though the government is blaming Pakistan and the Taliban for the attacks, the people in Kabul are largely blaming the government for not preventing them because its security systems failed very obviously and starkly in two or three major cases just within the past week.
Is there any reason to believe that this latest violence, even if it is in response to American air power in Afghanistan and maybe even policy in Pakistan, might be the necessary pain that you go through before the policy works and the Taliban is significantly weakened?
Afghanistan has gone through so much pain in the last 40 years. It's not necessary. I don't think that the military escalation is going to solve any problems or improve the situation. The United States government, when I was working there and even now, always says that it wants to wait for peace talks until it's in a stronger position. Therefore, it's escalating. But I think this is more evidence the escalation won't work. On the other hand, the government in Kabul and the people in Kabul and in Afghanistan generally are certainly in no mood to sit down and talk with the Taliban after these horrendous acts that they have carried out in the past few weeks. So I don't see any upside whatsoever in what has happened.
And this may seem like a naive question given what you just said, but is there any conceivable path toward a political settlement right now that will at least reduce the violence and get Afghanistan or Kabul on a different path here?
The only conceivable path would be one in which Pakistan would take some strong measures to curb the ability of the Taliban to carry out terrorist acts inside Afghanistan, which could help pave the way toward negotiations. But the fact is that anything like that is going to take a very long time. The feelings are now so high and bitter and angry that I don't even know if a meeting would be productive.
Barnett Rubin, director of the Afghanistan-Pakistan Regional Program at NYU Center on International Cooperation. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Here at home, over the weekend, billionaire hotel and casino mogul Steve Wynn was named in allegations of sexual misconduct going back decades. The Wall Street Journal published details Friday describing Wynn as a man who used his power to pressure women, including Wynn casino employees, into sexual acts. Then on Saturday, Wynn stepped down from his post as the finance chair of the Republican National Committee. The RNC and GOP politicians are now under pressure to return Wynn's donations. Here were some of the details of the Steve Wynn story from Las Vegas and Washington, D.C. is Rebecca Ballhaus. She's White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
So Wynn is a billionaire casino mogul. He's one of the most powerful men in Las Vegas. In 2005, he opened the Wynn Las Vegas, his flagship hotel and casino there. And he's also a longtime friend of President Donald Trump, who, of course, has also had some business experience in Vegas and owns a hotel there. The president in 2016 called Wynn a great friend. He appointed him as a vice chair on his inauguration committee last year. And Wynn is also a major Republican donor, although he's also supported Democrats in the past, including backing Obama in 2008.
We're going to talk about Steve Wynn's role at the Republican National Committee and what this might mean politically for Republicans. But first, Rebecca, what do we know about Steve Wynn's actions that led to him stepping down in the first place?
So as you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal on Friday published a report that interviewed more than 150 people who work for or had worked for Wynn. And what the journal found is something that amounts to a pattern of sexual misconduct by Steve Wynn that goes back decades. This included pressuring employees to perform sex acts, such as a manicurist who was called in to give Wynn a manicure and later told colleagues that he had forced her to take her clothes off and to have sex with him. The Wynn Resorts Board on Friday said its independent directors would form a special committee to investigate the allegations against him. But we've also seen a copy of a notice that was posted for employees at his hotel in Las Vegas that was telling them that they don't believe these allegations and that they stand by Steve Wynn.
Talk a little bit more about Steve Wynn's relationship with President Trump and, by extension, the Republican National Committee that the president controls.
So Steve Wynn really became much more engaged in Republican politics after President Trump entered the scene. He has given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Republican party committees in particular over the last year or couple of years. He's been a big backer in particular of the RNC, which supported President Trump's campaign after he became the official Republican nominee in 2016. And he's also been a big backer of Senate Republicans' campaign arm, the National Republican Senatorial Committee. After the president was elected in 2016, Wynn was tapped as the finance chairman of the RNC, where he's responsible for the party's fundraising. And he has, you know, helped the RNC raise, I believe, almost double as much as the DNC raised last year. So it's been a successful tenure so far.
Now, Rebecca, Republicans came down hard on Democrats when the allegations around movie mogul Harvey Weinstein came out. Weinstein was a big-time Democratic donor, and the politics of those allegations saw Republicans publicly telling Democrats, pressuring them, that they better return all of the donations that Harvey Weinstein gave to them. Have they responded in a similar in-kind way with Steve Wynn's donations?
Well, I think this has been one of the most interesting things to watch. There have certainly been calls for Republicans to return those donations, and some have. House Speaker Paul Ryan, I believe, had received something like $1,000 from Wynn and said yesterday that he would donate them to charity. But what's been really interesting is that the RNC, which was among the committees that hit Democrats the hardest over their Weinstein donations. They made a video calling on Democrats to put their money where their mouth is and return that money, has yet to respond to any questions about what they'll do with Wynn's donations, which have been sizable, not to mention the amount that he's helped them raise and the amount that they've paid to his businesses as part of him being finance chairman. They appear to have used his casino and hotel in Las Vegas several times to cater events or to host events there.
What are we hearing from other Republicans? You mentioned Speaker Ryan. What have individual lawmakers said?
Individual lawmakers, especially on the Sunday shows, have joined together, I would say, in calling for others to return those donations. Lindsey Graham, in particular, was one of the senators who was calling on his colleagues to return that money. But President Donald Trump, who has said he's a great friend of Steve Wynn's, has yet to respond to in any way to these allegations, aside from this interesting episode that we saw on Friday night, hours after our story published, the Wall Street Journal story published. And just as he was returning from his two-day trip to Davos, his Twitter account liked a Wall Street Journal tweet about the report on these allegations. And a couple hours later, I believe he unliked it. For the president, this is, of course, an uncomfortable situation, given the women who have come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against him, too. And the White House's official position has been that those women are not telling the truth.
Rebecca Ballhouse, Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
And now from newly exposed allegations to accusations of abuse that went ignored for decades. The entire board of USA Gymnastics is expected to resign this week after the organization's former team doctor, Larry Nassar, was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for sexually abusing girls. The story's now brought renewed attention to the accusations of all kinds of abuse rampant in USA Gymnastics for decades. In 1996, Dominique Mociano became the youngest American gymnast to win the Olympic gold medal at age 14. You might remember her, the young, impossibly tiny gymnast who took on daring routines. Here's an announcer talking about Mociano in the lead-up to the Olympics.
I think there's a grown-up trapped inside that 70-pound body. You know, maybe she's too young to realize the pressure.
About a decade later, Mociano spoke out about a dangerous culture in the gymnastics world and publicly accused two legendary coaches of abuse, the Romanian husband and wife coaching duo Bella and Marta Caroli. Dominique's allegations were dismissed for years, but over the last 2 weeks, more than 150 women and girls spoke out against Larry Nassar, many naming U.S. gymnastics as complicit in that abuse. So PRI reporter Jasmine Garz spoke with Mochianu about her experience in USA Gymnastics and how much things have changed since the time she first tried to make her voice heard.
When I first started speaking out, the former president of USA Gymnastics, he tried to assassinate my character, make me a liar, belittle me, humiliate me, mm-hmm. and ever since then treat me like I was a worthless person. And I was so disgusted by his behavior and the facade that they all put on television and this, oh, this greater than life Carolis and the ranch and all of that. And I said, it's all a lie. It's all a lie. I'm not buying into this. That is not who they are. You're glamorizing people who abuse children. How is that okay? And how come nobody's saying anything? And there were so many people trying to defend it. And I said, how can you defend the indefensible? That is not okay. It doesn't lead to anything good. Do you know the long-term damage to these young ladies when they leave the sport? Have you guys thought about that? No, because all they cared about was they were winning. So nobody was asking questions. And everyone kept saying, oh, well, their success is proved. It's proved because the medals. And I said, what do you mean it's proved? It's proved because the athletes and their personal coaches work hard.
As much as I know this is really painful, as much as you're comfortable, can you tell me what was going on with these coaches? I mean, for listeners who don't know, what was going on?
Well, there was a lot of screaming and belittling and body shaming and making you feel worthless and neglecting you. If you made a mistake, oh my goodness, it was because you were fat. And you were worthless piece of garbage. That's how they treated you. They chose to ignore you the rest of the time so they can prove they're more powerful than you and you are a worthless piece of garbage. At the Olympics, before I received my gold medal, I was crying. I was crying because I felt like a disappointment to Marta and Bella because of how they made me feel after my vault. When mathematically my vault actually won it for the team. And I just felt, I don't know, I worked all these years and I said, is this what it's really supposed to feel like? I felt empty and I felt saddened because I wasn't good enough. I wasn't perfect enough. And here I was, a 14-year-old. This was my dream for the last 11 years of my life. I spent 40 plus hours in the gym. I sacrificed so much. I had very few friends and I did it for this.
Do you think that what happened was that people got really emboldened, abusers got really emboldened, and it just got out of their hands? Or is it a culture that now we're ready to hear about this?
Oh, I believe it's a little bit of both. Because the people at the top were so corrupt and the environment was so toxic with the verbal and emotional, psychological abuses that everyone was too afraid to speak up. But that also emboldened the abusers, because they feel they'll never have any repercussions. The Carolis felt untouchable. John Gettert, who was an Olympic coach at Twisters, now is suspended. He feels untouchable. Do you know that he threatened one of the gymnasts and actually wrote an email to all the gymnasts who testified that were part of his program and said, how dare you bring up my name? He threatened them.
Dominique, I want to end our conversation on a positive note, because I love this sport and I know you love it too.
Definitely.
Something really beautiful that you always talk about is learning to fall back in love with the sport after the Olympics. Was there a precise instant that you can describe after you left the Carolis, you left the Olympics? Was there an aha moment where you realized, I love gymnastics?
You know, I always loved gymnastics. It wasn't that the sport ever harmed me itself, because the sport are just objects, right? But the aha moment was when I was a child and loved the sport for its purity and my innocence. And I loved that it was just such a beautiful sport, and I loved it. I thrived on that, and I was good at it, and I could excel and be very good at it and possibly go to the Olympics one day, you know, when it was all so innocent and so pure. I loved it as a child. I love it to this day. My children enjoy it. My son actually really has potential to go far, and that's why there's so many things that are going to change to better the future for not only my children, but everyone's children. And that's what I fought so hard for all the last, you know, 10 years, is that I knew that changes could help the future and have more positive and healthier experiences. And honestly, in the courtroom just a couple days ago, where I sat and supported the brave women that have come forward, I felt more love and support than I ever have at any USA Gymnastics event in the last 10 years.
That's Dominique Mociano, the youngest American gymnast to win an Olympic gold medal. She spoke with Jasmine Garst, a reporter for PRI's Across Women's Lives. That interview first appeared on PRI's The World. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. When you separate plastic and paper and haul it to the curb in that blue bin, where does it all go? Turns out the answer might well be China. Over half the world's recyclables get sent to China. But now China says it doesn't want to be the world's garbage heap anymore. And it's coming up with new, tougher standards for what recycling it's willing to accept. I asked Kate O'Neill to explain all this. She's associate professor in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. First off, after the recycling is in the blue bin, what actually happens to it?
50% of the plastic that we throw away as consumers will, in fact, wind up on a boat to China. At least it has up until now.
Well, China's been chugging along in this industry, Kate O'Neill, but now they want to change the way they're doing things. The new policy is called National Sword. What exactly is China doing here?
China is, as of March 1st, enacting very strict restrictions on certain kinds of scrap. There's 24 altogether, and these tend to be the lower quality scrap materials that they no longer want to take in. What they've done, in effect, is put contamination limits on these plastics that are almost impossible to reach. Contamination takes a couple of forms. One is that a lot of the plastic that we throw into recycling is still dirty, and that makes it much harder to recycle. Another issue is, in fact, mixed bales of plastic, and that mixing of plastics is very problematic in terms of separating what's recyclable compared with what's practically waste.
Are Americans going to be asked to rinse thoroughly all of their plastics before sending them off, or to separate them better, or does this mean that America will send its plastics elsewhere?
The answer is both. In terms of our everyday recycling, there's some evidence that municipalities who coordinate these policies are starting to place stricter limits on what consumers can put in their recycling bins. But the other part of this question is that already plastic scrap is being diverted to other markets in Southeast Asia. Malaysia, Vietnam are suddenly seeing a boom in scrap imports. That is a problem because we're not entirely sure what happens to that plastic. In China, we didn't really know all of it either, but we know that there was and is a huge manufacturing demand for those plastics. In these cases, we're really not sure. But I think one of the big concerns that we have is that even if the plastic is recycled, we need to be concerned under what conditions. And there's some evidence that in China, a lot of it is recycled in informal scrapyards, often with great danger to the health of the population who dismantle it, which are often children, and to local environments. There's a sense that the Chinese government is responding to some of these reports, and that was one of the triggers for them really to start being concerned about their reputation as the world's garbage dump.
Well, Kate, the broadest question, it seems to me, is whether the amount of plastics we produce all over the world, but certainly in a consumer economy like the United States, is ultimately sustainable. You can envision a world where we recycle 90% of the plastic we produce and a balance is struck. But you're describing a world where we're nowhere even close to that, not only because of technical capacity, but just political will.
That's true. And when I talk about recycling rates, our actual recycling rate in the United States for plastic is 9%. It's tiny.
Nine.
And this all adds up to a lot of problems that are really coming to the fore now. The other big plastic issue is plastics in the oceans, as well as the debris that is washing up on islands and beaches around the world that is just a huge issue for fish and for birds and other wildlife in the oceans.
Kate O'Neill, stick with us. We've got some more questions for you right from our audience.
Just curious to know if saves real energy or if it takes more energy to create a new object using recycled goods. This is Tyler in Boston.
Professor Kate O'Neill, it's a great question. Is recycling actually energy efficient? And I would add another question to that. Does it pollute?
There's actually some debate about the energy savings from recycling. Overall, though, once you look at the entire life cycle of a product, the fact that we're avoiding creating new plastics, at other levels, we're avoiding mining minerals from extracting minerals from the earth. We're also avoiding the use of conflict minerals and metals. There's more of a question about incineration. And, you know, I'm going to say something that a lot of people may or may not agree with. This is somewhat contentious, but there are ways in which we can efficiently incinerate wastes for energy, and there are many ways in which we don't. In the United States, it's been very problematic to establish a quality incineration program. But on the other hand, we look to Sweden, and Sweden now has a negative waste production, so to speak.
Sweden leading the way there. Well, Kate, part of China's new, more rigorous standards say that, for instance, a greasy pizza box might not be accepted anymore. And here's one listener from Massachusetts who's wondering then how we should guarantee that the items that we're putting into our blue bins actually get recycled.
This is Terry from Needham, Massachusetts. I am wondering if I can recycle juice and milk cartons. And if so, do I have to flatten them, rinse them? There's a lot of debate in our house about all sorts of recycling questions.
The general principle is clean your recycling before it goes in. It really depends on what your local municipality's policies are. For example, are they single stream in which you throw everything into the same bin and then it gets taken away and ideally sorted? But again, that may or may not happen. So in general, I urge people to really go talk and find out what's happening in their towns or cities and educate themselves that way.
Well, Kate, this next caller has a question that I think a lot of us worry about. I know I do.
This is Peter Dumont calling from Star Alliance in Berkeley, California. Berkeley is generally way ahead of the game on these things, but there's one thing that bugs me a lot. There's no convenient way to recycle batteries that we use all the time for computers and so many other things. Where is the sense in this? What are other cities doing?
Yes, batteries are a serious issue. They are quite toxic and one of the main contaminants of landfills, which is where most of them wind up. There are very few states, as far as I know, that mandate battery recycling. California is one of them, however. The main thing to look out for is when your municipality advertises a hazardous waste collection date for households where you can bring the paint, the batteries, The cleaning materials, all those things that tend to be hiding out in your basement, that's quite important to do.
And Kate, is that the same answer for how to recycle an old laptop computer? I've had this trouble.
Again, there's research required to find a venue that won't export e-waste. There's a lot of different ways in which municipalities and states here deal with electronic waste. One of the big things we need to confront is that we have all of the scrap from laptops and batteries all the way to plastic that is hard to recycle, often dangerous to recycle, but we don't necessarily have the markets in the parts of the world that can effectively deal with this safely to keep them in country. So the question is, well, if we do need to export them, how do we export them in ways that make sense? And the problem becomes, how do you ensure that they're dismantled or recycled in the recipient country in a way that's safe for the local community, for the workers, and for the environment? And that step is something that a lot of different people are trying to figure out how to make.
The world of recycling is changing. China is helping to change it rapidly. And Americans are wondering where their recycling goes. Kate O'Neill, Associate Professor at University of California, Berkeley, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Probation and parole has kind of grown like a weed in the yard. It used to be there was animus. People were tough on crime and they were out there passing bills. Now it's just sort of forgotten.
Nearly 5 million people in the United States are in the parole and probation system. That's more than double the number of people incarcerated in this country. And while there's been a lot of attention and advocacy around prison reform, you heard it there at the top, there's a lot less about probation and parole reform. Well, today the Justice Lab at Columbia University is releasing two reports. They're focusing on a major overhaul of the parole system and how reform can reduce the rate of revocation and mass incarceration. Vincent Schiraldi is the senior research scientist at that Justice Lab at Columbia University and also former probation commissioner for New York City.
Probation and parole grew far beyond what anybody ever could have imagined, and they were originally designed as a sort of rehabilitative individual program to help people turn their lives around. Now they've become really largely a processing system back into incarceration, and that needs to change.
Well, describe how that happened. People might have the impression that probation and parole were alternatives to incarceration, keep people out of prison. Is it working that way?
Right. That's certainly the way they were designed in the 1800s. But no, what happened was when mass incarceration started to mushroom in the late 70s and early 80s, mass supervision mushroomed right alongside it. So it went from about 1 million people to about 5 million people. And it was never designed to be that big. It was never funded adequately, even though it's got a lot more people on probation and parole. $9 out of every $10 goes to prisons. And so now you have bureaucrats, mid-level probation and parole officers, people that used to work for me, good people, trying to manage way too many cases with way too few resources. And while you might not be able to individualize and help people turn their lives around, you can write a violation report and send somebody back to prison, and so far too often that's what happens.
So, Vincent, you're describing a situation where probation and parole is so overwhelmed with convicted people that the default setting is just to send them right back into the prisons where they're not supposed to be in the first place.
That's right. And there's a lot of people trying to do good work. It's just that the system is too big to succeed, which is the name of our report. It just needs to be smaller and needs to hold on to some of the resources that it has that now go to prisons and jails to help people find housing, find jobs, get drug treatment, get mental health treatment, so that they turn into the kind of people we all want them to be, not just to process them back into incarceration at ever greater numbers.
Can you describe a little bit what happens to the typical convicted person? I'm going to say somebody who got a 3-year sentence, got paroled after 1 year, they're supervised, they're back out on the street trying to stay out of jail, maybe. And then typically, what might happen?
Well, very often it's kind of phlegmatic supervision. You know, there's a real life case of a Philadelphia rap artist named Meek Mill. A lot of your listeners may have heard of. He was given probation and sent to jail for 8 months, and then given probation when he was 19 years old. Now he's 30. He's been on probation for 11 years, which is pretty extraordinary in Pennsylvania. And 11 years into it, he popped a wheelie on his motorcycle as part of a music video and got in a fight in a St. Louis airport. And he was revoked on probation and given 2 to 4 years. He was actually given more time for the technical revocation on probation than he got for his original crime 11 years ago. And so 11 years on probation is nuts. 1 to 2 years is more what should be happening, because that's when supervision actually matters the most. Everything beyond that is diminishing returns. And it should be focused, intense, and rehabilitative during that time, not long and bureaucratic.
What is supervision supposed to accomplish in the first place? I think that's an important question.
Sure. So good supervision should focus on what people need to get back on a straight and narrow, help them get it. So that could be education. It could be a job. It could be drug treatment. and really supervise them well so you see them frequently enough to encourage them to go to the programs they're supposed to go to and help them work through the navigation of the system. And then as people do well, you should reward them. Some states now give you 30 days off for every 30 days you haven't gotten rearrested. And that encourages people to stay on the straight and narrow. And then at some point, you bang the gavel. You say, hey, you did a good job. You're off probation. You're off parole. Go forth and be the kind of citizen we all want you to be.
So the kind of case where somebody spends 11 years on probation and then winds up back incarcerated for infractions during that time seems egregious. Your list, Vincent, of recommended reforms, what would reforming this system look like?
So the first example I gave was Arizona and Missouri have done what I described. Every 30 days you behave well, you get off 30 days off your probation or parole term. And what that does is it gives people hope. It gives them something to work hard for so that they can get the reward that they want rather than just threatening them with punishment and return to incarceration. When those states did that, they had fewer people going to jail. They had fewer rearrests of people on probation. So that's really one thing. The other is just to shorten probation and parole terms so that the caseloads are small enough so the probation officers and parole officers can do the jobs they were hired to do. And then if people do get run afoul of the law, they violate probation, short hits, quick returns to prison. Louisiana, of all places, which is hardly a bastion of criminal justice reform, recently capped parole violation terms. You can't go back on your first two technical violations, non-criminal. And then beyond that, it's 15 days for the first one that you go back to jail for, then 30 days, then 45 days, and only 45 days for good after that, as opposed to 2 to 4 years that Meek Mill got.
Vincent Schiraldi, I wonder, though, if there isn't a risk that judges and prosecutors, if probation gets much shorter, right, that they might react by doing exactly what you don't want them to do, which is recommending longer prison sentences. Judges might react and say, well, there isn't as much probation available. I'm going to keep this guy in jail.
The states that have reduced probation and parole terms have not seen that. So we got a bill passed when I was probation commissioner that allowed judges to give people 5, 4, or 3 years on probation if they had committed a felony. It used to be only 5 years. Judges used that bill. They also were able to shorten terms at the end of probation. We would go back and say, this guy did well. Can you let him off early? They used that, and they still put fewer people on probation and parole and didn't increase the number of people they were sending to jail. And crimes continue to decline in New York City. So there is a way, and I think you're right. People should be concerned about unintended consequences, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't innovate and we shouldn't be careful about it and study it when we do.
Vincent Schiraldi with the Columbia Justice Lab at Columbia University and former New York City probation commissioner under Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Vincent, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The TV show, Another Period, takes place at the tail end of the Gilded Age in the heart of the robber baron stronghold in Newport, Rhode Island. But if you're expecting the refinement and dignity of your favorite costume drama, no. Take this little moment from the third season, which premiered on Comedy Central last week.
Pardon me, do you have 20 to 25 minutes to listen to a symposium on women's affairs? This doesn't seem to be working.
These petitions prove to Congress that we have the community support behind us.
I got one! Rutherford B. hates women!
Maybe we should just call it a day.
Yeah, we're basically, the girls are standing outside trying to get signatures, like kind of like people standing outside the grocery store. And Lillian and Beatrice, like, you know, they want a more flashy way. So we wear, you know, full body bathing costumes.
Bathing costume carriage wash?
That is just indecent.
They're hardly wearing any clothes. Are they getting signatures?
Seems like their way is working.
You heard Ricky Lindholm there describing the scene. She and Natasha Leggero are the creators, the stars, and the showrunners of Another Period. Ricky explains they play sisters, Beatrice and Lillian Bellecourt, in a very specific kind of crossover.
We think of the show as a family like the Kardashians living in Downton Abbey at the turn of the century. Like that kind of mix, like new money, tacky, mean, not ready for that kind of wealth, and just throwing their wealth all over the place.
They're, you know, they used to be fur trappers. They're just first generation new money, and they have billions of dollars. So, you know, they're pretty tacky.
Well, one of the best features of the show is just how oblivious your characters are. As like the really important things go on around them. People stop in on this show, Albert Einstein, Eleanor Roosevelt as a young woman. Then there was one time in season two when the girls met Harriet Tubman.
How do you think I became the Moses of my people? You think they just started calling me that on their own?
Well, we've never really thought about other people ever, so I don't know.
Well, honey child, I thought of that. You ever hear of Jelson Paramore?
No.
Exactly. Jelson freed more slaves than anybody in history. But he didn't know a thing about branding. He wanted to call it the slave connection. But slavery had such a negative connotation.
Why?
So I said to him, let's make it about trains. White folks love themselves some trains.
We really do.
Natasha, what am I getting a history lesson here along with...
Well, sometimes, I'll tell you, you know, when we had Harriet Tubman, we, you know, we have her at the age she would have been in 1902. So, you know, that is accurate. But, you know, what if Harriet Tubman was a branding expert? Because our characters are trying to get famous, and which is, you know, obviously very hard without any technology.
Sure. And there were only like 4 famous women at the time.
Exactly.
And so we're like, how did they get to be that way?
Well, look, I mean, one of the – I hate to dissect jokes in shows like yours because they really sell themselves. But one of the things that you guys do so well is just take the obvious political debates of the day and shove them into 1902. I mean, one of the characters just insists at one point that she has to have hatchets around the house. She has a right to keep her hatchets, even if her hatchets might hurt other people.
I'm just saying that I think this house would be a lot safer, especially my misbehaving hand, if we got rid of the hatchets or institute some kind of waiting period so I can get my head on straight.
Albert, that's crazy. Every man, some children, and me should be armed with a hatchet. I mean, think about it. If you'd had a hatchet, you could have killed your attacker before he killed you.
I'm not dead. He didn't kill me.
Either way, the point is, hatchets don't kill people. People without hatchets do, because they basically kill themselves by not having hatchets.
Ricky, you're on the verge of the National Hatchet Association taking over the show here.
Well, what's crazy is that episode aired the night, what was it, the night of...
The sit-in on the Senate floor about gun control.
Oh. It was so crazy.
Yeah, it was.
And we had concurrent. Written it like a year before, so I do feel like the show is kind of lucky in that way. It sort of finds its place.
So, Natasha, Ricky, you're both the creators and the stars of Another Period.
And the showrunners. No one ever talks about
that. And the showrunners, I was about to say, and the showrunners. And your experience as women showrunners in Hollywood means you run the show. How important is it to the voice of the show to have power in this process?
Well, tone is kind of everything. You know, being the last voice of everything. You know, we have all these talented people, you know, putting everything through the same filter, but it has to be through your filter. It has to all be unified or it doesn't feel like a show. So it's nice to be able to be the last voice on everything. But Comedy Central is great. We came to them, you know, sort of armed and ready, being like, Natasha and I want to show run the show. And they're like, all right. and we're like, okay. Well, then we will do it. Thank you. You know.
Also, it has to do with caring. Like, we care more about the show than anyone else. So, I mean, maybe our director as well, Jeremy Connor, who also does Drunk History. But, you know, I think, Ricky, you were saying your friend who's a big director was saying that, you know, the showrunner, like, you can look at the screen and you know what's wrong, even though no one else can kind of tell what's wrong, but you see it. You know, the showrunner kind of has every aspect in mind.
Natasha, you revealed recently that you were sexually harassed by director James Toback more than two decades ago. What's been the impact on your career, Natasha, and your motivation? Looking back on the experience now and the way it affected you then, and now being in a position where you're in charge and how you think about
it. I mean, it feels good for sure. I mean, it's definitely you get very used to feeling like nothing, you know, like you get very used to like rejection and you get very used to no. And it just sort of, I guess it does beat you down, but I think it definitely helped me in comedy because comedy, if you don't have a sense of humor and people tell you no for 20 years, you're going to be pretty depressed. Yeah, what do you think, Ricky? Well, you've been sexually harassed.
No, but when we created the show, Natasha said that she had looked at my IMDb and she's like, I've seen you've been in like 100 things. How many of them are funny? And so few of them were. And she had the same situation. And it was like, yeah, well, we know so many funny people. We're funny. How come nothing we're in is funny? And we just decided we needed to create our own thing.
And a lot of that is because, you know, men aren't always thinking about creating great parts for women. Mm-hmm. And men are, you know, predominantly the people who've been creating things. So, you know, I think it's great that there's more women out there than ever before just creating and writing and producing, directing.
And hiring each other.
Hiring each other. So, yeah. I think it's all very positive.
Is a version of the Me Too movement going to happen in their world in another period?
I feel like if we do another season, probably, yeah.
What would Lillian and Beatrice think about the Me Too movement?
Oh, they'd be against it. Well, the weird thing is I think these characters are secretly feminist, but they just have no idea because they want everything. They don't want to feel limited by their circumstances, but they don't understand that that is a feminist.
That's Natasha Leggero and Ricky Lindholm, the stars of Another Period. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. By Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And by Progressive Insurance, committed to providing efficient tools to enable customers to bundle home and auto insurance. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.